Hi, everybody. First off, before I start, I just want to say that I can't believe this is the very first Jay on the Beach. It's been so well run. I attend a lot of conferences, and this is already one of my favorites. So a big shout out to ITRS and Velo for their work. So I've been a software developer for over 20 years, and I've been helping people with service-based architectures for about 8 or 9 of those, believe it or not, already. And we've really hurt ourselves over the years trying to do things a certain way. And from the things that we've learned from that, we have since, you know, tried to build frameworks and tools that will allow us to not stub our toe in the ways that we've been doing it before. So this talk is largely about how at Lightbend we realized that we had Play Framework and Akka and all these great tools to help people build reliable software that scales very easily. But what we didn't have was a way to help people do that beyond these like primitive tools. They're primitive in that they only give you some basic tooling to do stuff, but they don't show you how to do stuff. So that's where this new framework that we came out with, Logom, has come from. And this is really about the story of Logom. So, how many people here subscribe to Gartner Group? Anybody? Yeah? Okay, 1, 2. So Gartner Group is something that a lot of executives listen to for understanding the pulse of technology. And Gartner Group has come to realize that the architectures we've been using up until now simply won't be the way we need to build software going forward. 5 years from now, especially with all these devices that are connecting back to our various servers and stuff like that, we're going to have way more clients than we do now. And how are we going to be able to build software that scales in the face of that? So, what are we trying to achieve? We have three fundamental things we need to do here. We need to accelerate our teams. And there was a really great talk about continuous deployment just a second ago. But it's beyond just what we're putting into production. It's making sure that our teams are able to work independently, right, and not be stubbing their toes on other teams' work and waiting for somebody else to deploy their stuff so that they can deploy theirs as well. So we're also trying to reduce these dependency nightmares, which come from having all of this entangled code. But then finally, we're also trying to increase our application throughput. And you could say that, hey, I've got an application here that, you know, doesn't have these high requirements of scale, so I don't have to think about that. And I'm going to tell a story of where we thought that, and that changed on us because the world changed on us. So, first of all, I want to say that the term microservices sucks. It's terrible. But it's the term that everybody uses to describe this new way that we're trying to build software. And I personally think we should call them isolated services. And by that I mean everything that we build, every one of these services has to be in control of its own fate. The teams that build them, the source code, the way they expose themselves to other services, all has to be completely isolated from other ones. And I'll talk more about that in a second. So this kind of isolation comes from several different levels. Ben Christensen, who is well known for having created RxJava, he was at Netflix, he's now at Facebook. He gave a talk, and you can find it on microservices.com, where he pretty much talked about the first two things I put in my bullet point here. The first is that it's really dangerous to expose a client for a service, something that other people are going to have to call through in order to reach our service. And you may see this with tools like RabbitMQ or something like that, where you're calling through a client to go back to a message queue, something like that. And the problem becomes if we have to upgrade that service or queue or whatever, well, we also have to upgrade the client people are using, which means the other services then have to also be upgraded. We have to think about our source code. If we have, all right, I was asking a few people this earlier, how many people have in their projects a sub-project called Core or Miscellaneous or Utils? Right, everybody. And I'll admit, I did this too. It's not like, you know, we knew what the effect of this was. But first of all, anybody who's ever used Scala, which is a language that, you know, Lightbend is well known for, knows that compile times can be a problem, especially with larger projects. And what happens when somebody commits something to Core, or Utils, or whatever you're going to call it, that is totally unrelated to your project, but that whole, you know, sub-project became a dumping ground for all of this stuff that no one knew where to put elsewise. Right? They just threw it in there because it, you know, it's core, it's miscellaneous, it may be being reused. But it's not in your project. And now you get that update from Maven or SBT or whatever tool, Gradle, and you're rebuilding. That sucks, right? So we need to have isolation inside of our source. This also has a fringe benefit, meaning that if that core or utils has a dependency inside of it, like Guava, right? When you go to upgrade Guava, you then have to upgrade all of the services that depend on this. And that's painful. So we actually are saying, I'm actually telling you, that we want to get away from the idea of reducing our reusability. I'm telling you that we want to have the same code in three or four possible places or something like that in lieu of having the shared dependency. Because if we have the shared dependency, that's what leads to these really long upgrade cycles because of all the entanglement inside of our source. So I would much rather have the same code in three or four places, 5, 10, I don't care, than a 6-month or 1-year project just to upgrade Guava, right? So that's a little odd because you hear a lot of people out there say, we want to be dry in our code, we want to reuse and everything like that. Yes, that sounds great. Do it inside of a service. Don't do it outside of a service. Don't cross those service boundaries. And then in our data, one of the earliest experiences I had in writing these kind of service-based architectures was we had all of these services, subsystems, and every subsystem had like 25 or 30 different modules inside of it. It was crazy, right? But then we had one database, and every single service shared it. And that meant that if one service had to upgrade the database, because there was no ownership of the data, well, that meant everybody else also had to upgrade their services. So every service has to own its data. It will be the only place from which that data is exposed. That doesn't mean you have to have a different physical database for every single service. You could logically separate it through things like key spaces in Cassandra or different schemas. But somehow you do want to maintain isolation so that you don't care between services about upgrades of data. Does anybody recognize this picture? It's the Titanic. And the thing about the Titanic was it had bulkheads, but they didn't go all the way to the top. They knew that bulkheads should go all the way to the top, but they didn't do it. And when that gash was created on the right-hand side of the ship, well, you know, water came into the compartments that were now exposed to the ocean. That tilted the boat down, which meant that water then spilled over the bulkheads, tilting it more, over other bulkheads, finally taking the ship down. We don't want that kind of thing happening inside of our services when we know that we need isolation, but we break it because it's a shortcut. So, we want realistic data management, and here I'm going to say some things that are really inflammatory to some people out there. I was just at a conference in China, right before I came here, and there were some extremely well-known academics in the data management field there, and they were talking all about how they could have synchronous, distributed, transactional semantics in their databases. And I said, what? No, that's not possible in a distributed store. They want absolute consistency. But consistency doesn't really exist. Not whenever you're talking about distributed stores, because of physics, because of the speed of light. You could have two things running right next to each other with, you know, a very simple network connection between them. But still, that's not immediate. And anything can fail in between them, like network cards or the cable or something. Who knows what? And so I asked them, exactly how are you doing this? And they just brushed it away as Paxos. And anybody who sat through Heidi's excellent talk yesterday knows that that's a communication protocol that involves a lot of interaction. It's not simple. So you can't just say everything always works. No, it doesn't. And I'm also going to say that one of the things that really annoyed me about this conference was that we had vendors there talking about how they had all these tremendous throughput numbers on their benchmarks, right? And the flip side of that is, that's not with the guarantees they were also saying that they could do. If they want the synchronous, consistent, distributed transactions, they're sitting there and claiming all of this performance when none of that is in place. So ask people whenever they're telling you these things, exactly what do you have in place there for these guarantees that you're putting in? So instead of worrying about, will my database always do the right thing whenever, you know, a network partition happens or a split brain, right? Why don't we move to a different model? One of the things that is really tough to think about if you're a DBA, is anybody here a DBA? One. All right. Maybe another. Nothing against the people who are DBAs, but typically these are people with frowns on their faces. A lot. Because they're always being asked by people to make the database performant for both writes and reads. And these are conflicting concerns. They're always at odds with one another. And so DBAs pull their hair out trying desperately to get writes to be as performant as possible and reads to be as performant as possible, and that's not really plausible with a single store. Instead, we need to move to a model where we say, all right, I'm going to collect all this data whenever it comes in or whenever I need to, and I'm going to do it in an event-sourced manner, because in doing so, I always have a way to reconstruct my data. Anybody who's ever used a relational data store and tried to reconstruct their data from the audit log knows what I'm talking about. It's painful. It's not easy. It doesn't just work. So instead, we have a write store. This is what we call CQRS, Command Query Responsibility Segregation. If you look closely, you will see it everywhere, even inside those databases that people were saying are doing the, you know, distributed, consistent, synchronous transactions. Really, under the hood, they're doing CQRS inside of it. They're capturing the things that come in, and then they're trying to push it out into something that is then readable, right, in some relational format or something like that. So this is a separation of concerns, and it can happen in a lot of different ways. Write store, read store. The write store just sits there and stripes stuff out as events are being, you know, are taking place. And then the read store is consumable. It is in the form that the people who need to consume that data need it. They get it in that form right away without any kind of transformation or joins or anything like that. And that gives you a system which has the characteristics of resilience and speed, right? You get that elasticity from being able to provide services that other people can consume that data in a really readable form. Now, transactions. How many people here are Spring developers? How many people have used @transactional from Spring JDBC? What happens when you try to update multiple tables in a transaction and it fails? It comes back to you and says, you know, there's an exception, right? You can't do it. What do you typically do about that? Anybody? Nothing. So the user sees a 500 error or something like that, and you've pretty much just kind of, you know, said, oh, well, try again. That's not good enough, right? That's not the kind of systems that we want to build that are going to be always available to our users. So instead, let's let go of the idea that we can do an update to multiple tables, and when 2 out of 3 succeed, that's a failure. That isn't a failure. Instead, we can build application, you know, logic, domain-centric logic that says, hey, 2 out of 3 things worked. That's great, but the third one didn't. I'm not going to just fail and throw that back to the user and tell them to retry. Instead, I'm going to tell them, hey, I'm working on it, right? 2 out of 3 things succeeded. The third one is going to retry, maybe with exponential back-off semantics, always limited in both time and space. With time, I'm saying that if it fails 5 times within a minute, space being 5 times, you know, time being the 1 minute, well then, you know, then I somehow have in my application this escalation to someone to allow it to be handled somehow, right, manually if need be. But at least we haven't said that the world didn't really have these changes. And we don't sit there worrying about things like how we're going to roll everything back. It's a much simpler model, actually. And then consistency. I talked to some really large database vendors who say, we want to rewrite your stuff, our stuff, using your platform. But we are known for our consistency. And we're not going to give that up. But we need to be distributed so we have availability. And this is the CAP theorem, right? This is the idea of consistency is always at odds with availability in the face of partitions. And partitions aren't just network failures. There are things like GC or really long-running CPU-intensive processes where you're not in communication with that actual work being done. All of these things represent partitions. And consistency is not something you get as a guarantee anytime you start distributing your work. So we have to let go of that and say, what is acceptable as far as how much time until I'm consistent? Or am I always able to retrieve a value that is the most recent update? You see this with Cassandra and Reoc and DynamoDB based upon the Dynamo paper from Amazon, right? This is where we're saying I can have updates coming into any one of n nodes. And at that point in time, whenever I say I need that data, will it give me the right answer? Even though I'm not asking the same node that got the most recent update. Those databases can do that, and they use tools under the hood that are very powerful. By the way, a lot of the things I'm talking about here could be a talk unto themselves. So if you need more information about things like CQRS and event sourcing, there are a lot of resources out there, talks that you can find, especially by people like Greg Young, who will help you understand the semantics of these kind of behaviors. Distributed locks. This is how those databases who say they're synchronous, distributed, and consistent work. They're trying to establish locks and say that I have the right to do something and you don't until I'm done. But what happens when you have a failure? That's something you see with things like data grids and data fabrics. Those things can work if isolated to a single service. But when you say I'm going to have a fabric that represents all of the data in my entire, all these systems that I have, well, the problem becomes, well, what happens when nodes go down and there's a lock established between these different nodes? Is it going to come back quickly? Is the data going to be reestablished that was in some of those nodes because it was sharded or replicated? How is that going to be available to you? And then what's worse is you actually have shared mutable state across a bunch of nodes here. And whenever those services need to be upgraded, if the services need to be upgraded, one service needs to be upgraded, well, what happens to the other services who depend on the same data? They also have to be upgraded. We've broken isolation. So the whole idea of sharing state, you can do caching, you can do fabrics, they have to be isolated to a service, at least logically somehow. And they should be immutable state. That way you always have the ability to rebuild your data. Oh, I really like this quote from one of my coworkers. It really comes from Martin Fowler's talk about microservices, if you ever read his blog post about it. Martin Fowler said, think in terms of compensation. But Kevin took it a step further and said, not prevention. This is the way we tend to think about systems, that we can think about all the things that might go wrong, but we can't. Cognitively, we cannot think about all the things that might go wrong. So instead of even trying to, have a backup plan for anything. And that backup plan could be one policy for, just about anything that happens. That's fine. But at least that doesn't take you down. Does that make sense? So, part of this realistic data management is the idea that we have to let go of the old acid. The ideas of atomicity, isolation, consistency, and durable. Instead, let's think in terms of associativity and commutivity. And those are big, fancy words for what are really simple concepts in math. Commutivity is just the idea that order doesn't matter. If we don't have to worry about order, then anything can happen in any order, and we're not concerned by that. And a really good example of that is this picture right here. It doesn't matter if I add 2 plus 3 or 3 plus 2, I get 5. However, if I subtract 3 from 2, or I subtract 2 from 3, I get different answers. That's not commutative, right? If we have a commutative scenario where order doesn't matter, and we're associative, where grouping doesn't matter, where, for example, I'm doing some work, but I have to wait for something else to happen, if I don't have those scenarios, associativity and commutativity together, I have linear scalability with both of them. And then I can scale up nodes and theoretically have linear scalability where, if I'm handling 100,000 things with one node, it's 200,000 things with another node, 300,000 things with another node. As an example of this, a really large consumer electronics company in California, in Cupertino, I can't name them, they have these devices and things, and sometimes things go wrong on those devices. And users of those devices may say, hey, I want to send a report back, right? You may wonder why I'm not talking in specifics here, but you can probably guess. But when those reports come in, it doesn't matter that one report comes in before another or after another or anything like that. And it's not waiting for any other information to be collated. So they can receive it, put it into Kafka, and then have subscribers that are going to listen to these topics, and they handle them through a pipeline and then put it into Cassandra, where incidentally they're running 75,000 node clusters. Two of them. That's pretty amazing. Well, they say to me, can we do that? And I said, yes, of course. Does order matter? No. Does grouping matter? No. All right, well, then you don't even have to worry about a clustered solution. You can have individual nodes that you spin up, and they can just handle work. And if any of them fail, bring up another. You can pretty much rely on system D, and you're done because of acknowledgement from that queue out of Kafka, that topic that you're listening to. So, awesome stuff. That's where you want to be. It's not possible for everything, but it makes your life a lot simpler. Idempotent, the idea that if I handle one message, if I get it again, I don't always, you know, add that $100 to my bank account each time. Because the reality is there is no exactly once guarantee of delivery. And you will see vendors come out and say that we have exactly once. They're lying. What they have is exactly once under some scenario. You'll see an asterisk. For example, you know, Flink does say they have exactly once. And in a perfect world, it does work. It's awesome. However, if the connections go down, no, it doesn't. So that's an assumption. Those assumptions are killers. When people say exactly once, they're not being truthful. The reality is we have to have at least once. We have to send messages multiple times because we never know whether we're going to get an acknowledgement from the server doing the work. And that means that they may be doing the work, it may be done, but we've already had our time elapse before we say, I need to send it again, right? And that means on the server side, it needs to know that that work has already been handled. So idempotent behavior on the service, the consuming side. And then distributed, because we want our services to always be available. And having only one up is itself a single point of failure. That means that you should have at least three. You do not want two. It's a rule of thumb in distributed computing that you always want to have an odd number of deployments. So you want three services, three instances of a service up and running at all times. We want real resilience. And this is something we're really bad at, myself included. We fall back to the ideas that acknowledgement is good enough. It's not. Acknowledgement has nothing to do with why things went wrong inside of the thing that was consuming that work. And so, what if instead we had the ability to do something as a result of the failure, as opposed to just saying, well, it wasn't handled? Acknowledgement is useful. It is helpful whenever you, you know, have a server go down in the middle of its work and it can't, you know, recover in some meaningful way. It can always be handled by another server. However, it's not enough. We want resilience inside of our threading model, inside of our application. We want it between nodes. We want it between physical servers. We want it between data centers. And this is all extremely important. Whenever I'm out there and I'm talking about things like Akka, it's all the idea of supervision. Something always has to be watching something else in order to make sure things are working appropriately. And that doesn't happen in all scenarios, in all technologies that you see out there. As a Java developer, whenever I'm sitting there and writing a callable or a runnable on a thread pool, right? What is the one thing I can do to handle a failure on that thread? Because I'm not going to find out anything from the thread I've spawned to do work. All it's going to do is, you know, put something up on the console. Is anybody's job here to watch the console in production? Aside from Quentin. Yeah. That's what he does for everybody. He's doing it now. No, I mean, that's not good enough. Nobody's sitting around watching the console, right? So you say, all right, well, I'll implement an uncaught exception handler for the thread pool, and that's going to help me. But then you say, well, what are all the possible things that could go wrong on all the things that run on this thread pool? And you think, oh, well, that's just about anything. So you just kind of catch exception and log it, which, mind you, is better than having things go to the console. But if you want real behavior that, you know, captures what to do when failures occur, you instead have to have a domain-centric thread pool. You've got to turn that thread pool into something that's only used for customer updates. Does anybody do that? No! Right? That doesn't make any sense. So instead, we do have tools now that allow us to have supervision at every level. Use them. They're going to be really important in helping you keeping your services up and running at all times. We want asynchronous APIs, and everybody's all really caught up in the big, you know, movement for HTTP REST, which, incidentally, is awesome. It decouples your services. That's good. We want that. However, it isn't always the best scenario. For example, while I'm using the term synchronous here, I'm not talking about thread asynchrony and thread synchrony, where you know I'm calling something and then I can go off and do other things kind of stuff. No, I'm talking more about the interaction itself, where REST is a synchronous protocol with a response to every request. So instead, let's get away from that when we don't need it. We can have services that expose a RESTful API at the exterior. And then behind them, they can depend on other internal services. And instead of having that RESTful interaction, we can have messages. We can have streams for things that don't require responses. And in doing so, make our systems more lightweight and use less resources. So that's really powerful. Here's an example. Imagine a customer service. And behind that customer service is another service called addresses and another service called phone numbers. Well, you may say that's a lot of crazy services to have, but then you think, well, it's not just customers that have addresses. Businesses have addresses and phone numbers, and they can be in different formats based upon, you know, their location around the world. So I'm going to have an address service, I'm going to have a phone service, and the customer service will be the gateway through which customer interactions are managed. That can be RESTful. But then the interactions back to the address service and the phone number service, which aren't exposed outside of the boundary of our system, can be through messages and streams. And they can serve data to all different kinds of clients because they're isolated and serve them in a way that each client needs. So another thing, and this is a little bit off topic, is we really want immutable deployments. Right now, this is an example of Dilbert with Wally sitting there saying they changed the configuration on the production servers. It's a really bad idea because now you don't know what's running on every one of your boxes. Instead, everything has to be fingerprinted. And by that I mean it's not just the, you know, the binary code that you're deploying, but also the configuration that goes along with it. That's really important. And in doing so, you always know exactly what's running on every single one of your boxes where they're deployed. And this will help you with versioning whenever you're doing upgrades. So let's move to this whole point where we have immutable deployments, and that'll help a lot. And finally, we want to expose only the tip of the iceberg. The complexity of my customer service having other services it depended on is irrelevant to somebody who is asking for something from the customer service. Doesn't matter. We expose the tip of the iceberg, and all the details of what's happening behind it are irrelevant to the people who are using these services. Now, how many people here do domain-driven design? A few. It's one of those things. It's been around for 10 years or so since Eric Evans published that book, Domain-Driven Design, and another one came out about 4 years ago called Implementing Domain-Driven Design, which took it a bit further, made it a little bit more modern using current architectures. It was from a fellow named Von Vernon. These books help us define how our services are broken apart. But the tricky thing here is a lot of us don't have the ability to say that I'm starting from scratch. And you can't take a brownfield project, one that already exists, some big monolith, and say, I'm just going to split it up into a whole bunch of aggregate routes and bounded contexts. Now, nobody does that. So you don't, right? In a greenfield project, this is a great way to figure out how your services should be segmented. But in a brownfield project, you don't always have this luxury. And in this case, this is where I'm going to give that example I was talking about earlier. So I worked at a large cable company in the US. They had 40 million subscribers. And in 2000, 2001, they deployed a JEE application with a large relational data store behind it. And everything worked fine. Had all the customers, all the accounts, all of the, you know, channels that they watch and stuff like that. But what we didn't see coming was on demand. On demand, where you're sitting there and saying, you know, it's 9 o'clock at night and I missed that show yesterday, so I'm just going to pull it up on demand and now I'm going to watch it at this time, which is great, right? That's such a fundamental shift in the way that we watch TV. Well, every one of those clicks with your remote is a web service call to figure out what entitlements you have to watch TV, what channels you can watch, and therefore influencing the menus that you have, you know, inside of your UI. Well, that really started crippling our relational data store, right? Because it couldn't handle all of these read-based requests with all of these writes that were also taking place when people would call up and say, I want to be able to watch Game of Thrones. That's not good enough. So you don't have to tear everything apart. Instead, you have to solve your pain. You just have to split out the parts that matter, that aren't scaling inside of that monolith. So what we did was we built an entitlement service. And that entitlement service had all of the data in the form it was needed to be consumed by, you know, the set-top boxes or the tablets that were making these calls. So you would have an account ID to all of your channels. You would have a MAC address for the device to all of your channels in the form needed right away. But now we've got a problem, right? We've got data in this large data store, the relational data store, and we've got to cache it over here in this readable store. How are we going to do the transformations when things change? On the assumption that the relational data store is our source of truth, which is a valid assumption, right? That this will always be updated. We don't care about what's happening before it. On the assumption that that large data store you know, was always going to be in place and have the right data, you could emit an event from it and then capture the event and put it into some sort of message queue. And you could have people consuming out of that message queue and updating the store that we were using for the cache, which in this case was REOC, because it was a Dynamo store that had key value semantics for that account number to all their entitlements. Awesome. Except the problem is time. You don't know that the event will come out of that store. You don't know that it will be successfully put into the queue. You don't know that the queue is actually going to successfully transmit it across itself. You don't know that it's going to be consumed by somebody at the back end. You don't know that the worker is going to put it into REOC. There's a whole bunch of things that can go wrong, and if any of them do, and you don't know about it, because it's entirely plausible, you are out of sync. And if you're out of sync in something so critical to your business as this entitlement store is to the cable company, well, that's bad. So how are you going to fix it? What we did was we instead said, let's always recalculate entitlements. I'm going to get all the accounts. I'm going to get all the customers. I'm going to get all of the channels and et cetera, all the devices. And those are really simple queries that don't take down a database, because it's like select all from accounts. And then I have data that's coming in from other sources that I use to calculate the entitlements, put them into REOC. And when I'm done, I do it again. And when I'm done, I do it again. And the eventual consistency semantics are now such that I only have to figure out how many workers I need to meet the latency requirements of my system, right? If the business rule is that I cannot exceed 50 milliseconds in 5 minutes before somebody can watch a channel after they call up, right? Then I've got to meet that, and it's easier than worrying about all the time-based semantics where a partition could occur. Something could be slow, who knows what? Zombie machines. It's a train wreck out there sometimes. But we don't care because we'll always self-heal. That's how we build resilient systems. And the best part about it was I didn't even have to think about the deletes. Whenever a customer said, I don't want to be a cable company for this company anymore because you stink. I didn't care because I put sessions into my REOC store. I said, if I didn't update you at least once a day, well, you know what? Tombstone the thing by yourself. Let the database clean itself up rather than you trying to put in expensive delete calculations or delete queries, right? That's the one query that is always most painful. So let the database do the thing it's really good at. Awesome. Didn't have to write code. That's a win. We will, however, have additional complexity. This is not all free lunch. You're going to have to deploy more services. You're going to have more of this continuous deployment infrastructure in place to make sure that this is working for each one of the teams. Yes. And you're going to have to think about all of these dynamics of upgrades. Those are all things that aren't easy. But you know what? I can have multiple versions of a service running at the same time and quiesce from the load balancer which requests are going where. You know, flip the switch, they all go here. And do the remainder of the work on the servers that are on that previous version and then shut them down. This is actually pretty simple to do in Akka because I can have messages that say, I have done my work here, I've done my work here, I've done my work here, trickling up to the point where the server can say, I'm done, and shut itself down. Quiescence is the key. So now we get into logum itself. And it's pretty funny, actually, we named a framework, you know, with the word lag in front of it. You know, people have questioned us a little bit about this, but it's a Swedish word that means just the right amount. And I've been working really hard on my pronunciation here. Logum. Is that correct? Woo! All right. Any other Swedes? Am I doing all right? Yay. Woo! All right. Because you can listen to this on, like, you know, Wikipedia. They'll have, like, sound things on what logum should be pronounced like. And it comes with four things. The service API, the persistence API, a development environment. How many people here enjoy redeploying just to test? whenever you change something in your source code, especially for a distributed system. It's not easy, it's painful. And Logum does this out of the box, where you're sitting there, you just save, and it automatically redeploys your test environment and runs tests. Boom, done. And then the production environment, which does involve some of our own IP, but is totally pluggable with things like Kubernetes and HashiCorp's Nomad and whatever other tools that you want. Like, some of it is still in progress, like we're working on it, like the HashiCorp one, the Nomad one, but it's coming. Because we're not going to sit there and tell you, you have to use our tooling to go into production with this service. We think it's bigger than that, right? So let's have a look here. This service API, it's just the I/O and the communication, right? And this is where we get these things that we call bounded contexts, the places where we have isolation between our services. We have the persistence API, where out of the box, we're giving you Cassandra and saying you're going to use this in an event sourcing way, much like that talk that was given earlier where the woman did the jogging and stuff like that with their IoT using Apache Spark and Cassandra, doing event source, so you always had time series data. That was a really big deal. And now you don't have to worry about any of that object relational impedance. Now you're going to use Hibernate, JPA, things that make us grind our teeth. And this is where you get things like aggregate routes in DDD, right? Where you're saying that I have all the customers, or I have all the accounts or something like that. If you need to go with a CRUD-based store, you can. We're not going to sit here and say, this is the only way to do things. No, you have the ability, but we're going to keep you away from it as much as we can because we think it's wrong. We do. We might be wrong, but I don't think we are. Not at this point in time. The development environment, the ability to save stuff and be able to test it with an in-memory Cassandra right out of the box helps a lot. And then a production environment that says, you know what, just give me 3 instances out there running on my footprint. Done. I didn't have to do anything else. It bundled it up for me, the fingerprinted configuration with the binaries, put it out on 3 servers, and then manage the fact that, hey, servers go down in a way, I'm going to bring another one up on one of my other parts of my footprint. So your footprint should always be larger than the actual running place. Have 5 nodes for your 3 node deployment, or 4, right? Have those 4 physical or virtual servers for your 3 node deployment. So you have some redundancy, and you can always say, bring it up on another node. But it could bring it up on a same node if need be. And that's really important now, because then we're no longer worried about how we're going to do this manually. And tools like Conductor, like Kubernetes, like Nomad, those are all very helpful in doing so. The thing that's different with Conductor is it's peer-to-peer. It does not have Zookeeper under it. And Zookeeper, for all its gifts that it's given us, is a place where there is a single point of failure in the management of the configuration. And so you look at Kafka, one of the biggest things they're working on right now is to get out from under being on Zookeeper, where you have a consistent view of data, the configuration always being managed, so that they can be peer-to-peer. This is a big deal. We think peer-to-peer is a much better model, as do Cassandra, as do React, and anything else that's doing that gossip protocol style work. If you want to find out more about this, here are some links, but how much time do I have? I have 4 more minutes. Is that good? All right. Am I right? 4 more minutes? Yeah, okay. And I know people want to drink beer and have fun and listen to the band and all that, so I won't keep you long. But if we look at a build file here, oops, I'm not mirroring. But if we look at a build file here, and I apologize for the fact that this isn't syntax highlighted because I'm too lazy to write one for SBT files, you'll notice that I have a multi-service project here, and this is all available on GitHub through the links that I just showed you. And I define each one of these projects, and I have the dependencies enumerated where projects need to talk to each other, right? And then, whenever I go out and I say that I want to run this, pull this over here. I start SBT. This will take a few minutes. What jokes can I tell while this happens, right? Hopefully I don't have any new dependencies I have to pull down or anything like that. But believe me, we wanted to make this work with Maven. That was one of the critical things that we were actually really focused on doing, because we released this as a Java framework first. And that was for a couple of reasons. For one, it's really difficult to turn a Scala project into something that is an equally available Java project. And by that I mean with all the same semantics. We struggled with this with Play framework, and only in the last 6 months did Play really meet parity between Java and Scala. Well, we saw this whenever we acquired the Spray framework and we needed to make it available for Java. It was incredibly difficult. So instead, we started with Java here. And also because, let's face it, Java's a really big market. It's not a bad idea to, you know, give them something as well. But then all I have to say is run all. And it starts up everything. I don't have to do anything else. It starts up every one of the servers. And in this case, virtually running on a friggin' MacBook Air with Cassandra, right? And it'll tell me when everything's up and running here with the service locator, with the service gateway, all done. And the whole thing can be run and just locally on your box with multiple services deployed. That's pretty fantastic. So it's up and running now, actually. So no JS detection failed. What is that about? Anyway, so it's a really neat project. And it's an MVP right now. I won't say to go out there and start writing this in production yet. But think about the things I've talked about here and apply them in the ways that you're building them with other technologies as well. This isn't just Lightbend's view. This is pretty much the view of everybody who's built microservice-based architectures so far. And their best practices, no matter what tools you're using. So find a way to build your systems in this way, and you will have the future in hand. Here are the links. The project site is lightbend.com/logom, github.com/logom. And then there's documentation, but you can find that by going to the lightbend.com/logom as well. And that's it. I'm sure there are a lot of questions, but I also don't want to hold everybody up from going out to the party. So if you want to stay and ask questions, you know, that's great. If you want to go and go to the party, I'm not offended. We'll take questions until everybody's ready to go.